Welcome into the latest episode of the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Fowler, and today is Monday, May 10th. This latest episode features an article published in the April issue of the journal Oncology, and it's titled Focus on Transitional Disease, a Critical Interval to Delay Progression of Prostate Cancer. The lead author, Dr. E. David Crawford, he's a urologic oncologist and professor of urology at the University of California, San Diego. We spoke and he really explained a little bit about their research into prostate cancer, specifically disease stages. Among other things, Crawford and his research team spoke a little bit about next generation imaging, biomarkers, and really redefined prostate cancer disease states to introduce transitional disease into that equation. Dr. Crawford, thank you so much for agreeing to hop on the podcast to talk a little bit about your research. I really just wanted to get right into it and ask what motivated you and your colleagues to pursue this paper and the specific focus on prostate cancer.
This manuscript actually is part of a continuum of publications that we began about 4 or 5 years ago. That first publication was something called RADAR, which RADAR 1, which stood for Radiographic Assessment for the Detection of Advanced Recurrence. And why did we do that? Back in 2013, when we first met, there really was a lot of confusion and different guidelines relative to imaging and prostate cancer. Some of the things were a waste of healthcare dollars, where men that presented with a localized low-risk prostate cancer ended up getting bone scans and CT scans and so forth. And the yield on that was very low, yet people did it for defensive reasons, for malpractice and other things like that. But a lot of it just wasn't understanding. And then when people failed their local therapy, when do you do assessment when their PSA goes up in advanced disease? And so that led to this group getting together and publishing a paper called RADAR 1, which put forth these guidelines. And still, we're quite proud of this. This is one of the most downloaded manuscripts in the area of advanced prostate cancer. So this led to several other RADAR manuscripts. The next one was on called therapeutic layering, and that looked at putting different drugs together to improve the outcome. Again, that's grown now, and RADAR 3 had to do with the new imaging that's out there, next generation imaging. Some of the things we're all familiar with that are coming down the pike in prostate cancer, PSMA, gallium, and oximum scans and others. And then now even theranostics hooking these things up. So this current manuscript was outreach of RADAR 4, which was basically convened to evaluate these next generation imagings and assessing and where patients fit with metastatic castrate resistant and non-metastatic castrate resistant prostate cancer. In the process of doing that, it became apparent to us that our current map of prostate cancer and how we view it really should be reassessed. And what we suggested was this new state of disease called transitional disease. And that is where we wanted to sort of put up a firewall so we don't have people progress to metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer, which is treatable, but it's sort of at the end of the line in a non-curable disease. So our goal here was to really raise awareness of the all the new methods we have, including drugs and diagnostics, and focus on how we can implement these in men to sort of slow down the path to advanced metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer.
And so really this, if I understand correctly, this manuscript is kind of a call to action to kind of intervene in earlier stage of cancer progression. And there's a section of your manuscript on preventing progression that was particularly interesting. I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the data that you analyzed in that section and what role it kind of plays in this whole process.
Well, this is one of the things we utilize to substantiate our feeling that it is worth preventing progression. A lot of people were thinking, and investigators over the years, that when you have a treatment and you use it and it doesn't work, you may have a situation where if you would have waited longer and used it, it would have worked. And so it's this thing about burning a bridge early and then saving some arrows in your quiver. What we were using as an example was were three drugs and very rapidly accruing trials showed that in men who had a failed local therapy and were placed on hormones and their PSA was going up, and they were castrate, that adding some of these new third generation drugs I call anti-androgens, they're androgen blocking agents and other things like that, that in fact, this was really a game changer, because it's at this time, the endpoint for approval of drugs with the FDA was improvement in survival rate. And these people were relatively early, and what was accepted was a delay in progression as an endpoint. And all three of these drugs, they were apalutamide or Erleada, enzalutamide, Xtandi, and darolutamide, Nubeqa, are all these third generation antiandrogens, which when utilized compared to standard therapy, and then significantly delayed progression. And most recently, we have survival benefits that exist for at least two of them. And so that was an idea of where preventing progression was important. That the second mention that we made in here was the moving up of these things, these drugs like these and others earlier in men with newly diagnosed metastatic disease, not just treating them by lowering their testosterone, but adding this on and showing that it did improve survival rate sometimes by 17 months or more, which is very significant. And the question arises in both of these models of early intervention and being aggressive was, what's the issue with side effects? Are we seeing more? And are we really seeing an improvement in survival, or is it something called lead time bias, basically where one, in fact, just does something earlier, but the end result is the patient's gonna die at the same time. And I think others have shown very strongly that that's not the case, that these drugs are well tolerated and that they do make a difference in outcome.
So transitioning really to the conclusion portion of your manuscript, there are a couple things that were really fascinating that I wanted to point out. And I'll start with that you and your colleagues write a model to describe the continuum of prostate cancer should fill four needs. Could you talk about each of those individual needs and kind of expand on those ideas?
Sure. I mean, the prevailing sort of disease state diagram that we all use over the years has been somebody has a clinically localized disease and they get a treatment and the treatment fails, and we have this thing called PSA, which prostate-specific antigen, or you can call it patient-stimulated anxiety or physician-stimulated anxiety, comes along, and you suppress it with androgen deprivation therapy a whole bunch of different ways. The PSA goes down, but then the patient's PSA starts going up again, imaging is negative, and you have this whole disease state I just talked about where we use these three new drugs. And then with another way that people get in the door is that due to the lack of early detection efforts with COVID and way before that, lack of knowledge of screening, men present with urinary problems, bone pain, and they present with newly diagnosed metastatic disease. And so the thought was is that these two sort of the non-metastatic castrate-resistant, metastatic castrate-sensitive disease, both sort of behave alike and then eventually progress to metastatic castrate-resistant disease or the failing to respond to most things. And so what we said is, okay, we have imaging now, we have new drugs, we have to rethink what this sort of a death march people undergo with as they progress to advanced prostate cancer. And let's say, okay, we'll go along. We think there's no question is clinically localized disease. But then the next thing that people migrate into is biochemically recurrent disease. And some patients who have newly diagnosed metastatic disease with very few metastases might also fit into sort of the same outcome. We call that oligometastatic disease. And then the next bucket is this transitional state disease. And that's where we have people that are this NMCRPC, low volume, newly diagnosed metastatic disease, and even de novo oligometastatic disease with a reasonable number of mets, and that we can arrest the patients at this state with some of the new the doublets that have been out there and studied, adding to ADT, third generation anti-androgens, androgen biosynthesis inhibitors like abiraterone, chemotherapy, all these things that sort of you hit the brakes with the disease. And the idea is that you keep patients from entering into the metastatic castrate resistant disease. And the concept withholding some of your good therapies until later doesn't totally make sense. We have to be careful how we put things together that we don't have additive toxicities. And those steps are being taken. We have two and three drugs put together right now that are improving survival rate by 17 months or more. That's a big step forward over our standard therapy. And the thought is, with a lot of cancers, the reason that you cure some localized prostate cancers are you get them earlier with lesser tumor burden. And so, again, we have these new treatments. Can we move those down into earlier state disease? And so, but the important thing here is that this transitional cell state that exists, I keep saying transitional state that exists is important to focus on and throw our best treatment out to people when they're in this transitional state.
And so taking a step back and really looking at the manuscript as a whole, for someone who's reading this paper or, you know, someone who hasn't but is listening to this podcast, what would you suggest their main takeaway be from this work?
Well, I think that what we've done is thrown together a whole bunch of new bits and pieces of information with radiographic evaluation, with improvements in scanning, with next generation imaging. We've coupled that with the data that are coming out and are out regarding improved outcomes when we implement therapies earlier, when we use beyond the standard androgen deprivation therapy, but we do doublets and even triplets and things like that. And that we are able to step back and look at what we've said in the past about this is the path people go down, and that now there are recognizable areas where intense evaluation and therapy makes a difference.
Lastly, is there anything from this manuscript that I haven't asked about that you think is important to share and you really wanted to emphasize in this space?
No, I think we've covered it very nicely, and we've talked about the states, we've talked about the imaging, we didn't talk much about molecular markers. We do have genomic markers that help us direct responses and things like that. So in general, this is just the sort of the next step about we've made a lot of advances. Let's just step back and take a look at it and see what it means and how we can educate people to get involved with this and make a difference.
That's great information, Dr. Crawford. I want to thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me about your work. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for this opportunity, and hopefully we'll see some integration of this and further improvement as the outcome of men with prostate cancer.
The response perspective was actually written in the Journal of Oncology for this article, and that comes from Dr. Raina McKay, who's an associate professor of medicine and urology at the University of California, San Diego. I was able to speak with McKay, and she provided some of her thoughts on the idea of redefining prostate cancer disease states and really emphasized the need for clinical research to ultimately validate treatment options and current practices. Dr. McKay, thank you so much for joining me for the perspective part of this episode. Really, I just wanted to start for someone who hasn't, you know, read the piece in the journal. Could you explain what exactly you produced for the journal in the latest episode, latest issue to really supplement this article on prostate cancer?
Absolutely. So I think we're really at a critical time with regards to understanding the different clinical states of prostate cancer. I think historically, we had defined states based on, you know, not to say archaic modalities, but we had PSA, we had CT scans, we didn't have novel imaging, we didn't have genomic profiling, we didn't have all of these new technologies that are really changing our diagnostic approach for prostate cancer and really actually, you know, dovetailed to therapeutics and how we change and augment clinical management. So I think the piece is really timely because it's focusing on where we were with regards to the clinical states of prostate cancer and where we can be with the advent of novel technologies. So, you know, historically, we define prostate cancer based on localized disease, and you've got low, intermediate, high risk, and then you have biochemically recurrent disease, and you've got, you know, metastatic hormone sensitive, metastatic castration resistant, non-metastatic castration resistant, and those were sort of the defined states based on PSA and bone scan and CT imaging modalities, not taking into account, you know, biomarkers and other novel strategies. And I think we're kind of moving into a different space. You know, the non-metastatic CRPC space is ever shrinking with the advent of more sensitive specific nuclear medicine imaging like PSMA PET scans and whole body MRI scans. And we're now integrating multimodality treatment for patients with low volume metastatic disease with consideration for radiation to the primary for people who have not had that prior, and integrating, you know, stereotactic body radiation for people with oligometastatic disease. So I think our treatments are evolving based on our evolving technologies that we're really kind of able to better define clinical states. That was a very long-winded answer of you know, where we were and where we hope to be. And I think that's what the piece touches on.
Right. And so we heard from Dr. Crawford, one of the main authors of this piece, in the first part of this podcast, and he really touched on the four proposed categories for prostate cancer that they write about, which include localized, biochemically recurrent, transitional, and advanced disease. I just wanted to get your take on this as well. You know, what did you think of this proposal, and how do you see it impacting the current treatment paradigm for prostate cancer?
So, you know, I think it's very commendable on part of the authors to offer sort of a reclassification of the states, but I think, and we need to likely reclassify these states.
Right.
But I think some of the things that are not necessarily taken into account was transitional is a very ambiguous term. And what does that really mean? How are we defining that state? Are we defining it radiographically? Are we, you know, and how do we have these definitions apply to regulatory approvals for drugs? So I think we need to redefine the states, but I'm not sure the current construct that's actually laid out in the article is going to be the end all be all of how we do redefine these states. I think it needs to happen, but I'm not sure the proposed methodology of how it happens is the right strategy. You know, the prostate cancer working group 3 criteria, and now soon going to be 4, because I know that the prostate cancer community is working on developing some additional guidelines there. You know, really was developed for how to design clinical trials in advanced prostate cancer and integrating, you know, novel strategies. So I think we need to be integrating some of these criteria into these redefined states. And it's probably going to take some discussion with regulatory bodies like the FDA for, you know, okay, how do these states align with future drug approvals? You know what I mean? And right, future diagnostics and therapeutic approvals. So I think, you know, and then advanced disease is also, you know, again, pretty, you know, ambiguously defined. Like, how do we define that? You know what I mean? So, I think we need to maybe refine the definitions a little bit more specifically.
Right. And that idea is really one of your main points of the perspective that you write. And another, what I thought was a significant part of that written perspective, is focusing on the need for clinical trials to really fill areas of unknown research. Could you talk a bit about this and really some of the key areas you'd like to see research focus on moving forward in this area?
Absolutely. You know, I think that we're kind of, you know, now that PSMA PET imaging is being used more readily, Axumin PET imaging, a lot of, you know, novel imaging modalities are being used. Additionally, with people undergoing genomic profiling for advanced disease, you know, beyond just homologous recombination repair, gene alterations, we're finding other gene alterations. And I think people are doing things, you know, in clinical practice that isn't necessarily been proven or validated by clinical trials. For example, you know, low volume oligometastatic prostate cancer, you know, I'm going to go ahead and treat your primary, give you some spot radiation to all the sites I see and give you hormone therapy. Maybe I'll intensify it, but I'll plan to stop it in 2 years. I see a lot of that in clinical practice, but there's no clinical trial that was ever designed that's the way we should treat advanced, you know, low volume prostate cancer. Yeah. So I think we need to kind of pull back on the reins a little bit and you know, actually test out these strategies that are being applied in the clinic left and right to see if they actually make people live longer. Because I think, or they make people feel better, or they, you know, what is the metric that we're going to judge success by? So I think, you know, we need trials that integrate the novel imaging modalities where we're testing these newer approaches. We're testing therapy to the primary. We're testing therapy to oligometastatic disease. We're testing what's the right duration of therapy. Is it indefinite for people that are treated with somewhat curative intent, or can we stop after 2 years? You know, we need trials to do that. And that means we need people to kind of feel comfortable putting patients on trial where they're randomized to not receive that sort of therapy because we don't know the right answer. So I think, the field has some progress to make in that regard.
And kind of touching on a little bit about PET imaging, you mentioned there's a recent FDA approval of GA68 PSMA 11 PET. And you mentioned that it's a landmark takeaway really for men with prostate cancer. Could you expand on that a little bit and really what makes it so significant?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty significant because one, it's, you know, PSMA PET imaging in and of itself is, you know, it's not to say it's biologic imaging, but it's getting beyond just let's see a mass and see the size of the mass and but it actually is getting a little bit to the biology of prostate cancer because as people develop more advanced disease, castration resistant disease, PSMA expression, we know actually can increase over time. Now it's not, you know, pure. Yes, there are tumors that don't express PSMA, but large bulk of tumors do express PSMA. And I think the addition of both anatomical imaging and functional imaging, is one really important. And then I think, you know, it's one more sensitive and more specific to prostate cancer. So can we identify disease at earlier states? The detection levels at lower levels of PSA, we're now able to actually identify radiographic evidence of metastases, where historically those people would have been just called biochemically recurrent, non-metastatic. So I think it's allowing us to detect disease earlier, and it's allowing us to detect lower volume disease. And hopefully in the future, it may be a marker of response to therapy. They have PET avid disease that over time goes away if they're responding to treatment. And I think one of the challenging things with prostate cancer has been imaging of the bone and, you know, what is real, what is not real, what is treatment flare or, versus not, you know, there are no criteria for response assessments in the bone that are really validated and robust and used. So there's the potential for PSMA to do that. So I think it is a landmark event because I think, you know, imaging in prostate cancer because of the bone-only nature and because of the fact that we have a tumor marker that can give insight into the fact that there is a recurrence, but we can't see it radiographically. I think it is a landmark event, but I think that, you know, there are still big strides that need to be made to actually operationalizing this and making it something that's going to be available to every man with prostate cancer across the United States, you know?
Right. And so I think you started to touch on this a little bit and you did mention the idea of clinical trials earlier, but so following that, even though you mentioned this is such a significant kind of landmark for this disease, you write that there are still questions that remain in the management of prostate cancer, specifically oligometastatic disease. So besides like the validation via clinical trial, you know, what do you think is like the biggest remaining question that needs to be answered and what makes it so significant?
You know, I think the biggest question that needs to be answered is, you know, historically we have treated patients based on CT imaging and based on bone scan, and we have defined patients into these different spaces based on that imaging modality.
Right.
What's going to end up happening with more sensitive imaging is you're going to have patients who would have otherwise been called localized, who are now maybe localized, you know, oligometastatic. And the question is, are you going to hold back therapy from them because now they're metastatic? Or are you going to intensify therapy for them because they're low volume metastatic? We really have no idea. And so I think people are going to end up changing their practice based on what is seen on PSMA imaging. But we don't actually know that change in practice results in an improvement in overall survival, because historically we've defined patients based on CT and bone scan. And now we're going to start defining patients based on PSMA, but we haven't yet validated in any trial that this new classification scheme is going to be, you know, how it's going to be important. You know, I think it's also going to impact trials that are being done right now for localized disease. If PSMA imaging gets implemented, you know, disease endpoints like metastasis-free survival, well, if you have a better imaging test that detects metastases earlier, it's going to affect your endpoints for those clinical trials. So I think, yeah. I think we just need to be doing trials that embed PSMA imaging in them to be able to, you know, really answer these big pending questions about how to treat patients with locally advanced or metastatic disease.
And so really kind of taking a step back, because I think there's a ton of valuable information in both the original article that was written and your perspective on it. Just for someone who's reading these pieces of work or listening to this podcast episode, just one takeaway, what should their main takeaway be from both of these?
One, we've made tremendous progress in prostate cancer diagnostics and also therapeutics. But now is the time to, with that progress, you know, test new, you know, questions that have arose because of the introduction of novel, you know, imaging modalities and diagnostics in the field. So I think this is actually a positive thing for men with prostate cancer and the field in general. We just need to hone it in.
Absolutely. And so lastly, just to sum things up, is there anything that I haven't mentioned regarding this article or your perspective that you think is important to share?
You know, I think the other thing that is being done more broadly now is genomic profiling for men with prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And the NCCN criteria have now have recommended that all men with high risk localized prostate cancer, recurrent prostate cancer, advanced prostate cancer undergo germline testing, and those with advanced prostate cancer metastatic disease undergo somatic tumor profiling. And so now there are sort of instructions to ensure that we are broadly testing folks, testing their tumors to see if there's an indication for a therapeutic, testing their germline to see if there's a hereditary predisposition for cancer and whether cascade testing needs to be deployed to, you know, family members. But I think the problem is that there's it's sort of a mandate without appropriate resources for rolling this out broadly in clinical practices.
Sure.
That historically have not, you know, done this. You know, I think, you know, ensuring that a urology-based practice that may see high-risk prostate cancer or people with low intermediate risk disease that have a profound family history or have intraductal disease, you know, they may not necessarily have the bandwidth or capacity or know about to set that process up, and referring everybody to a genetic counselor is also not feasible because there's a huge workforce issue there. I mean, we don't have enough genetic counselors if every man with, you know, if 50% of men with prostate cancer are needing genetic testing, you know, there's not enough genetic counselors to handle all those individuals. So I think, you know, the other piece is how do we systematically offer germline testing with appropriate pre and post-test counseling to men for which there is an indication to test? And how do we systematically offer somatic tumor profiling in both academic and community practices to make sure that, you know, men are being tested to see if they're candidates for olaparib or rucaparib or pembrolizumab or some of these other targeted, you know, therapies that are now FDA approved for treatment of advanced disease. So I think it kind of dovetails with the clinical states because it's the therapeutics that go with that.
Dr. McKay, thank you so much for the insight and spending some time with me to talk about this work. I really appreciate your time.
Of course, my pleasure.
Make sure to subscribe to the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcast. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review. We would love to hear from you about what you want to hear, what you think of the podcast, and what we can do better going forward. This podcast, the Oncology Peer Review On The Go podcast, is the official podcast of Cancer Network, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information and the latest news in oncology, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.